Welcome to Byte Action Podcast. For those who don't know, Byte Action Podcast is on a mission to bring you raw and filtered journeys of experienced and influential people in video games and creative tech industries. If you want to understand how games are made, who are the creators behind your everyday entertainment, and what it takes to build successful companies, games, and products, then you should give this a listen.
Thank you for inviting me anyways.
Yeah, my pleasure. My pleasure. You were recommended to me.
I'm glad.
So yeah, I mean, glad to have you on.
How is the podcast doing?
It's all right.
Getting traction?
A little bit. Yeah. I mean, I've just started it.
Yeah.
And I mean, so far I'm enjoying it personally. Like the reason I started is because mostly I just wanted to kind of get to know people in the industry. I think like Barcelona has so many people working in the games industry in general. So it's just an opportunity to like meet people in person and more and kind of expand my horizons a little bit as well. So
yeah, great idea. Great idea.
That's why I'm doing this.
At some point, I wanted to do a radio career. So now it's a podcast thing, but it has crossed my mind, but I just haven't jumped to doing it. But
it's good. No, maybe one day.
if I'm ever not busy, you know.
Yeah. Understood. So you mentioned your parents came here, or your grandparents came here from Mexico, right? So how long ago?
No, the other way around. Right. My grandparents are from Spain, and they flee to Mexico.
And then your parents came over here.
Yeah. Well, my mom and dad, they were divorced since I was a baby. So my mom has a husband, but he's like my second dad, so to speak. And we've been moving around quite a bit from Mexico to the Netherlands because my stepfather is Dutch. Mm-hmm. And from the Netherlands to the north of Spain, in Galicia. From the north of Spain, I went to Mexico. My parents moved to Barcelona. I caught up with them in Barcelona. Then they went to the Netherlands and I stayed in Barcelona. And then they went back to Mexico and I stayed in Barcelona. So I've been here for 20 years now, almost. Oh, 19.
God. That's a long time.
Yeah, very long time.
I arrived here 3.5 years ago.
Ah, how is it going?
Good. I love it. Yeah. I came here during COVID.
How was that experience?
It was weird because, so I arrived here with my family, with my wife, and at that time, 6 months old.
Yeah.
Baby. So we arrived here, and I think it was like October 2020.
That was brave.
And yeah, the reason we did it is because we always wanted to move to Barcelona and COVID sort of pushed us to do it a little bit as well.
Sure.
You know, nothing is happening in the world anyway, so might as well, you know, come and do that. So we drove all the way from Lithuania. That's where I was based at that time.
Wow.
And that's where I'm from originally. And yeah, I mean, it took us like 4 days, I think, 5 days. So we did a few stops.
Jesus.
We managed to arrive here. Wow. And it was dead here. I mean, there were a few restaurants open and stuff, but yeah, that time
dead, but with good weather.
Yeah, right? Exactly. It was at least warm. It was nice.
And sunny. Yeah,
it was
nice.
But I love the city.
Yeah, it's great. I mean, I lived in the city before, and now that I live in the outskirts in the province of Barcelona, I wouldn't change it.
So you live in Sitges?
Yeah, I highly recommend you visit it.
I was a few times.
You've been there?
Yeah,
okay.
I was there a few times.
Yeah.
We go in summer quite often.
It's part of Barcelona province.
Yeah. We usually go to have like nice lunch.
Yeah.
It's not busy.
Walk around. It can get very busy. Like there's always something going on. There's always a party. There's always something that the town hall is celebrating. Like this weekend is the patchwork festival.
What is that?
It's just people selling stuff for patchwork crafting. That's it. And all of the promenade, the seafront promenade, it just gets filled with people selling their stuff for patchwork crafting. And in a couple of weeks, it will be like the old cars rally. So old cars, like very old, from the 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s, they start in Barcelona and people drive them, and the last stop is Sitges, and they dress up like in
how cool
like if they were from those dates.
How cool.
And
where is it going to be in Barcelona? Do you know? Maybe I'll go see.
It starts in last year it started in Lilla Diagonal, the shopping center. It's in Diagonal Francesc Macià Plaza. Does it ring a bell?
A little bit, yeah.
Francesc, it's very close. I'll give you the address. Okay. It's a nice shopping center, by the way. They start there and they start driving all the way.
Okay.
They get to Sitges. And there's always something. And then we will have maybe, I think it will be the Pride Parade, and then there will be like the Fiesta Mayor, which is like the local festivities. And since the Sitges has two saints, like two patrons, so it's two festivities, one in the summer and one in September. And then the International Film Festival.
Okay, so there's a lot going on.
Yeah. Oof. Yeah.
Very nice. Very nice.
Yeah.
Sitges. I actually went to Castelldefels.
Castelldefels. One stop before. Yeah.
The other day. It was similar.
Me.
Nah, no. You don't having a bit of a rivalry.
No. Not even. There are parts of Castelldefels that are. I don't.
It seemed like very quiet. Like there was no one there.
Yeah, no. I'll stay in Sitges for as long as I can. I've been there for 6 years now. Already, yeah. So
it's a beautiful drive there. I mean, I never went by train, but I went a few times driving, and it's very nice.
Like the highway, or like
the highway.
Curves, you know,
the highway. I don't know. You can see like there's what I call the mountains, maybe like hills, and I don't know. There's nice houses around, and you can see the sea.
Yeah, I cannot do the curves and everything around the mountain. It's like no, impossible. Like,
yeah,
I get dizzy in the train, so just imagine that.
And the worst is when we went a few times to what's it called? I keep forgetting now. Not Montjuïc, the other one.
Montserrat. That's the name of one of my sisters.
Yeah.
Montserrat.
How many sisters do you have? Must be a fun household.
All women. So I have an older sister.
Uh-huh.
And we both are daughters from my mom and dad. Like, and then they split up, and my mom had another two with my stepfather, and my dad had another two with his wife. So we're...
Got you.
Yeah, I have five sisters.
Got you. I have a brother and a sister. Similar situation. My parents split up.
Yeah. I don't like calling them half-sister or anything. They're exactly. My sisters, and that's it. Yeah.
Nice. So do you speak Dutch? You lived in the Netherlands?
I lived in the Netherlands. I speak Dutch. That's questionable. I used to be able to maintain a basic conversation. I can still understand quite a bit of it. But speaking, it's another thing. I can read some of it.
Mm-hmm.
I'm missing a lot of vocabulary, but I was able to, when I was there, I was able to have like a conversation with a five-year-old, sort of speak. Okay. Like very basic, but I could communicate.
A bit like me with Spanish.
Maybe, I don't know. Maybe. You'll get there.
Yeah, one day.
And then Catalan.
Yeah. You speak Catalan?
Yeah. I never went to school or anything. You just picked it up? Yeah, just by being here.
Mm-hmm.
I still have trouble speaking it sometimes because I mix it up with Spanish or my brain goes directly to Spanish because it's like, oh, Catalan is similar. It is, but it isn't. So my brain goes like, oh, it's easier for you to speak Spanish, so you'll speak Spanish. So I'm not, it takes me a while to warm up, be fluent in Catalan, but I understand it 100%. My husband is Catalan, so...
Wow.
Yeah.
Here, when I try and speak Spanish to people, they just switch to English automatically. Like, I can't be bothered with you.
You're lucky in Barcelona, there's a lot of English speakers.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it's easy to get by in that way. I think the only time I really need to use my Spanish if I run into some car troubles and I need to go to a mechanic. And that's when I really need to speak.
Especially if you speak with, like... local shops or with older people, you will be in trouble.
But it's fun. Look, I like it. I wish there was more opportunities for me to use Spanish, yeah. but yeah, I mean, I'll get there. My wife, she's fluent in Spanish, so that's helpful.
Wow.
I need to resolve any
issues. Is she issues. Spanish as well?
No, she's from Romania originally.
She's from Romania. Ah, but that's a Romance language.
Exactly.
Romanian and Spanish... they have their similarities.
Yeah. So for her, I think she was speaking before, but when we moved here, she got it like very quickly as well. So.
One time I went to Romania and I was shocked at how many people spoke Spanish. And they told me, we picked it up from telenovelas, like from soap opera.
Same with her. I think she used to watch it. She told me she used to watch it with her grandma.
But I find it shocking. I'm like, I don't think Spaniards would be able to pick up Romanian if they were watching Romanian soap operas. But everybody was speaking Spanish. It was shocking. We went to Transylvania.
Ah, nice.
That area, of course.
Nice.
I had to be
to visit Dracula Castle.
Of course. And in some places there around that area.
Did you go just to visit or was it work related?
No, visit. Just with my ex, we grabbed a car and we just went around and it was amazing. So cheap.
Driving there is a bit crazy though.
I don't
know if you drive.
Drivers are crazy. It was good fun. It blew my mind, the nature and the landscapes and the people. They seem very cold, but once you start talking to them, they are very kind.
Yeah, a lot of nice people.
But they seem aloof at first.
Yeah.
And then they start talking. And you're like, and
once they open up.
And then you're like, oh no, they're not aloof. They just have resting witch face.
Yeah. That's a good way to put it. Yeah, for sure. Cool. So talking about the games industry.
Yeah.
How did you end up in the games industry? Like, what brought you to it? How did you find your first role? And how did you get into production eventually?
Yeah, that's a lot to unpack there. Ah, you have a remarkable.
I do. Do you use it?
I have a super note.
I don't know that one. Is it the same?
Kind of.
Okay.
Different feel.
I like it, though.
Yeah, I
use it for this especially.
It's brilliant. I use it
for work as well.
I love mine as well. Yeah.
Lets you focus.
So I've been playing video games since I was, I don't know, 4. I was born in 1985. So boom of old school video games, but they weren't old school back then. But my dad, he was always wanting to have the latest in technology, like the latest TV, the latest console, the latest everything. And he really liked playing. So I started playing very, very, very young. Also, when I visited my uncle's house, my uncle, he's a graphic designer and he had a computer and he had Doom in his computer and Civilization. And I was like, I want to play computer games. And I didn't know what I was doing, but it was amazing. And I being a gamer, my favorite console, I think, is Nintendo 64. Still to this day.
Okay.
I love it. And I love the games there. With my dad and my sister, we used to go to Disneyland every year, which was great. From Mexico to Orlando, Florida, it's not that many hours. And I love Disneyland. I love the attractions as well and everything. So there is a component of entertainment there. But also in the hotel, they had arcade games. And to me, arriving from Disneyland, going to the swimming pool and then dinner and then arcade time, it was the best. And I don't know how many hours I played Mortal Kombat. So I was like a very girly girl. Then I don't know what happened down the road. But when I was a kid, I was a very girly girl. But at the same time, I loved playing Mortal Kombat. And at some point, my parents were a little bit concerned because I also played at home and all of other games. And I even had blisters in my fingers because I didn't have any strategy. My strategy was pressing all the buttons until I get a combo. And
see what happens. That's how people play Mortal Kombat.
Yeah, it's amazing. And I love the blood and the gore and Street Fighter as well. I still have my Street Fighter figurines at home.
Mm-hmm.
I loved it. I grew up, I knew I wanted to do something kind of creative or artistic. I studied audiovisual arts and then sound engineering because I also love music. But I think I love it so much that I don't think I could dedicate all my time during the day to sound or to music. I think it would have spoiled the experience for me. Whereas it doesn't happen in video games. Because in video games, I will talk about it later, what I do in production. The more I work in this industry, the less I play games. Like I do play games, but I barely have time. So the experience hasn't been ruined or tarnished. So I did my studies between Mexico and here in Barcelona and I finished and I knew I wanted to either work in the video games industry or animation.
Mm-hmm.
I tried animation and it's good fun. It's somewhat similar, like the disciplines are somewhat similar and there are similarities and transferable skills as well. It took me a long while to get into animation as well. Like there weren't that many internships or programs like today we have, that you have a lot of programs for youngsters that are graduating. And there was also an economical crisis here in Europe in 2008.
Yeah.
So it took me a long while. But once I landed into animation, I tried it and I was like, yeah, but this is like telling a joke and waiting for 2 years for people to laugh. Whereas in video games, like you can keep trying things and you can do A/B testing, you can do playtests with people or even with a team. It's much more reactive it's interactive. And I found the people to be more fun in video games, more geek, if that makes sense. Mm. They were creating technology, but at the same time, entertainment and art. And how I came about being a producer, so I knew that I wanted to do either animation or video games, but I didn't want to be an artist or a designer, even less so a programmer. I tried to do some coding and I'm not good at it. I really am not. I wanted to know it all. Mm-hmm. I'm the kind of person that I used to love watching music videos, for instance, but I loved watching the making of even more.
Okay.
So yeah. I used to remember, I remember that I used to like Thriller from Michael Jackson. My dad had it in Laserdisc. That format is like a dinosaur, right? But he had Laserdiscs. And I loved the video, the music video, but I was like, I want to see the other side, the making of. And for me, that was amazingly entertaining. I like how things are being done. I like the making of. I enjoy the result, but I enjoy the journey or the how we make things even more, the process. And that's the key word for a producer, process.
Sure.
And I said, okay, I don't want to dedicate myself to a specific craft. I want to know it all. What can I do? And at the same time, I was working in other industries, technology and whatnot, and I learned about project management and agile and all of these things. And I happened to be pretty good at it, very organized. I am able to materialize abstract ideas and put it into bullet points, if you will, so people can digest it better and understand it, and organizing people. I love working with people and creating synergies and good communication. And I didn't know this is what the producers did until I started learning about it. I'm like, this is where I'm going. I'm going to do production. And 9 years later, here I am.
Here you are.
Yeah, after doing animation, I was able to land a job for a Lithuanian company called Tutotunes.
Interesting.
Yeah, they are top-notch when it comes to games for kids, apps. So there are mini games and you download the mini game, whether in Apple or Amazon or Google, they're for mobile or tablet. There was in the boom of tablets and they're better played in tablet if you ask me. And there were games like not even educational, it's not ed tech or ed games. It's more like dress me up and put some makeup, and it works with layers all of the time. Like you grab a brush and you put some makeup on the unicorn and then you put some stickers on.
Sure.
And then you had in-app purchases. And they are still very much alive and thriving, but they tried to open an office here in Barcelona and I was the first employee. And I hired the rest with the whoever was the main representative. It wasn't the CEO, but it was like the head of studio, so to speak. Mm-hmm. He was part of business, if I'm not mistaken. The business model that they wanted to do in Barcelona didn't work out. It wasn't a good approach, in my opinion, either, because it was like we onboard the artists, they create the art, we show them how to put the art in the in-house platform, which was like a drag-and-drop system. They could create a game very easily. The mechanics were pre-programmed, and it was just a matter of like creating everything in the builder. And then we launch the game and we check the revenue. And according to the revenue, we give them a profit. So they had to do all this work without knowing if the game was going to be successful or not. Exactly. And I didn't agree much with it, and the Barcelona branch doesn't exist anymore because that business model wasn't working. Mm-hmm. But whatever they have in Lithuania, it's working pretty well. They still very much exist, and they are up there with other companies that do similar things like Toca Boca, which is more educational, and other studios. Okay. I took it from there. It was a rocky beginning because King had not had just landed, but landed only like a few years.
How long ago was that? How long ago did you?
That was like in 2000, let me think, 15?
Well, okay.
Yeah, something of the sort. And King has been here for a while, but they weren't brand new, but almost like they had been only here for a couple of years. Mm-hmm. But if I want to get there, like they were requiring things that I didn't have, and there weren't any internships. Ubisoft has been here forever as well. Console.
Yeah.
They were only hiring like very veteran, senior people. And to this day, there still are. And then later on with the years, Ubisoft Barcelona Mobile opened. And there were other companies, but I didn't have a career. I only had animation. I did also a little bit of VFX in publicity, advertising. And it was a rocky beginning for me to kind of knock down the doors and say like, hey, I have transferable skills. I've been doing project management for some years now.
But did you find the guys or did they find you?
I applied for Tutotoons and they did a test and everything. And I remember that I had, it was a group test. If we could use the in-house builder, the game builder and everything. And I remember I had a guy next to me who was struggling and I just offered myself to help with the test. I don't mind. Like whoever's best gets the job. I don't know. I don't have that ego to say like, oh, don't copy me. That sort of thing. I saw him like he was struggling. I helped him. But it seems that that's what got me the job, apparently. But yeah, and after that, I did some here and there for free. Mm-hmm. For some minor studios, they were like, hey, Maria, because I've always been good at that. So I was selling myself a little bit on LinkedIn, being very active. And then people called me and said like, hey, we cannot pay you, but would you like to come and help us out with the art production? And in the meantime, you learn a little bit. I was like, yeah, sure. Let's do that. Little by little, I started building my
reputation.
And my career I've been very lucky, and I'm very glad that some people actually saw the skills in me, because I wasn't a newbie. Like I had been working already for a lot of years, especially in technology. So they could see that I had the transferable skills and the knowledge. They even asked me things about games or production or technicalities that I just picked them up very, very quickly. And they were like, how do you know this stuff? I'm like, well, I talk to people, I absorb information, I study, I don't know. Like some things, this came very natural to me.
Well, sometimes you need these natural skills and you can't really explain them. You need to be good with people, you know, you need to be able to kind of present yourself in certain way. And, you know, as you say, you know, some of the skills, some of the hardcore skills that you learned in Agile and all that, you know, skills are kind of transferable into the games industry.
Yeah.
So, talking about all the roles that you've done in the past, has there been a role that you did after Tutotoons where you kind of you felt like you kind of transitioned into, I wouldn't say being like a full-on professional producer, but yeah, somewhere where you know really felt like, okay, you know, this is
the real deal.
This is the real deal. This is me. This is a career that I want to pursue based on this experience that I've just had.
So I knew that this is what I wanted to do, but there was definitely one experience that actually landed things for me. And it was like, oh dear God, this is serious. Like it can get very, very complex. That was when I joined Omnidrone, who this studio is part of Scopely now. I don't even know if it exists still, but Scopely definitely exists.
Scopely definitely exists. I think they became a part of Scopely.
They did. Yeah. They did.
I don't know if they like a standalone studio or if they...
No, I know that they did, but I don't know if they fully absorbed it. And I don't know if Omnidrone still exists. Maybe it does. I don't know. But at the beginning of Omnidrone, my team was made up of 25 people.
Right.
When I left, I lost account. Like, there was people that I didn't even know. But anyways, when I joined, I was actually called by the producer on the other project. So the studio had two projects mm-hmm. in partnership with Scopely. So Scopely hadn't absorbed Omnidrone, but they were working with Omnidrone already. So there were two projects, and the producer, who's still my friend, on the other project, he literally sent me a message on LinkedIn. I don't know what he saw in me or what, but he was like, hey, I think your profile is very interesting. Would you like to have a coffee? And it was actually quite close from here, and in the street is very close from here. And I was like, yeah, sure. I need a job after other experiences that didn't work out, and I wanted something more serious. And we had a coffee that in theory was going to be 1 hour, and I think we stayed talking like for 3 hours about everything. Yeah. It was great times. There was great chemistry, mm-hmm. and he was like, and he's quite experienced. He had been in Ubisoft for 8 years. Previous to that, he was in Digital Chocolate, which was one of the old studios back then. And I think Digital Chocolate split up or something, and some of the people went to King and the other people became Omnidrone, something like that. I don't remember the story very well. So he knew the head of studio and the CEO from previous times. So he was experienced, but he was still like talking to me and digging deeper and very interested in my background and my language skills or whatnot, and just in me. And we had a very lovely time talking about everything. And then he said, you know what? I think I am going to make a recommendation to move forward. And we're looking for a producer. We don't need someone super, super experienced, but we need the right person for this team. It's a small team of 25 people. Mm-hmm. The game has been in development for mobile for a year and a half or something. We're just going on to soft launch, and we would need a producer just to take it further. I was like, yeah, sure. It was great. I had an interview with the CEO, but I also had an interview with everybody in the team. And this was an idea from EMEA, or he was the programming lead. And
interview with all the 25 people.
Yeah. He was like, let's see if she can put up with the pressure, because if she's going to be a producer, then she needs to be able to speak to everybody and feel
talking
the pressure.
About tests.
Yeah, but I had so much fun.
That was brilliant.
Like we had a massive table, and everybody was, when they suddenly saw me, I mean, when I suddenly saw them the other way around, I was like, I didn't know that I was going to have an interview with this many people. And it seems that it was his idea from MA, who I still have a good relationship with. And it was great. And I think I passed with flying colors. And then the final interview with the CEO, etc. There wasn't even HR back then. It was like a small family where on Fridays, someone would go down for beers or snacks or whatever. And we had the budget, like how much it was spent in a paper, because somebody had to pay. And then we passed a note to the CEO. Like, it was very old school, like very family-like, very indie, very, I don't want to say amateur, but more like indie. And I really enjoyed that. It was great. But then we started growing. And then Scopely became a more important part of the game development process, both for this project and the other project. And
so they're like a publisher to you guys, or?
It was more than that. They also took executive decisions mm-hmm. in terms of where the games were going, the KPIs needed, the concept. And they added more layers of verticality to our team. At the beginning, it was only myself, production, and I worked with a group of core leads. I was mm-hmm. part of the core leads, which was the design lead, the programming lead, and the art lead, and myself. And we had our mini group, but it was so agile, so smooth. It was like a dream team. But the team had to grow, the complexity of the game had to grow, etc. So then came in general manager from Scopely, and then an executive producer from Scopely, another design lead from Scopely. So they embedded Scopely people onto the onto the team. We try to work as a team without making any differences. And in the end, Scopely kind of absorbed Omnidrone in its entirety. But Omnidrone had been working with Scopely for a long time now.
Yeah. So the reason you feel that this experience kind of lifted your whole knowledge of what being a producer is, like, what's the reason why? I mean, like, what happened during that? How long did you stay there? A couple of years?
2 years and a half, almost three. Yeah, because it was nonstop meetings, like serious meetings with Scopely, not only Scopely in Barcelona, but Scopely in LA with real stakeholders, real numbers, real data reading, although that took a little bit of time. Okay. And I was so shocked at the intensity of, like, I was not prepared. Like, the first week, I even got sick. That happens to me quite often when I join a job. I think I'm so excited and I
want to give you all.
Yeah, I want to give it all that. And I get sick at the first week. But yeah, it was so intense and so serious and with so many factors. And I also learned a lot about mobile game development. I had touched mobile before, but not to that depth of complexity where you have different environments in programming, even testing environments and what does it entail, merging protocols. I learned so much about being a producer, and I learned a lot about the core leads as well. They were veterans, and I learned a lot about people management as well, and stuff like road mapping and more like product and KPIs. And a lot of what I am today as a professional, I learned it in an intense crash course of 2 years and a half, almost three.
Yeah. Sometimes you need those experiences, you know,
like that. Just kind of
being put into a deep end and see if you can swim.
Yeah, yeah. And that has been the case in the majority of the jobs that I've been in. Like, I've always been thrown to the deep end, but that time around, it really got serious. Like, it was complex and there was a lot of money involved in the game. I didn't have visibility on the budget.
Okay.
And I learned to manage Jira by myself, and I became the Jira ninja, as they call me. I loved setting up workflows that they were lean and clean for the team. And I started learning a lot on my own and experimenting with things. And I earned skills that nobody taught me. I just had to swim, but they came natural. It was great. And I love the people. We had so much fun. I have very fond memories from my time at Omnidrone, for sure.
Yeah. I mean, being a producer, as I said before, like, it's important to be a people person, right? So you need to build relationships with everybody on a team. And every person is different, right? So you need to learn what triggers them, what makes them happy, what makes them angry.
Yeah.
So you need to find, I guess, those factors, and you need to build relationships with every single one of them. So, like, the question here, I guess, is just more about, you know, how do you foster this environment where, you know, everybody wants to come to work and everybody's happy to work in the environment? And, you know, how do you, as a producer, like, what strategies or kind of what methodologies maybe you need to kind of do or create in order to create this environment where people love working in and they want to come to work?
Yeah, basically. That's a good question. And I don't have a magic wand. Mm-hmm. I wish I had. So sometimes I have to be the bearer of bad news and the scapegoat for a lot of things. And I know that I'm not everybody's cup of tea, or that they are not comfortable with the work because of things that they don't depend on me. Like, if there were some creative direction decisions that definitely don't depend on me, then I cannot change them. That's not my role. But my role is to be as transparent as possible and to provide people with enough information. What I do is I try to earn people's trust. I like to listen to them. I've taken courses on assertive communication that has helped me quite a bit, and I took therapy. And that might be something that people say, like, what? Like, not only for my personal stuff, having therapy or taking therapy has made me a better professional. you're more grounded. You are the backbone or people's mm-hmm. rock. So if you are rocky or shaky, or if you don't have enough emotional intelligence, then that can trickle down to the rest of the people. This is something that we can talk about later. And what I look for when I recruit producers as well, I look more for the soft skills rather than the hard skills. But anyways, so I earned their trust, I listened to them, and I could communicate very regularly with the people as much as I can. Even if I'm head of production, production director, whatever have you, I like to be in touch with people. I don't want to be this god in the Olympus, like up there in the cloud that is untouchable. Like I am there in the same boat rowing so we can get the game shipped. So with that said, I try to maintain a good level of transparency, and this is something that I always advocate for. And I have to poke sometimes the leads or the line managers or mm-hmm. the executives, like, hey, this information should be passed down to people. I don't like the information flowing top to bottom, not even bottom to top either. It needs to be all directions, so we are all aligned. That's kind of like my motto, alignment, and that's the most difficult thing.
Everybody
to
knows what's going on and why they're doing.
Yeah, but with caveats, of course, and with nuances. You cannot expose everything because not everything will be beneficial either. And in production, we also kind of act like umbrellas. We shield people from some stuff on the executive level that can be concerning or damaging to them. But then we try to digest it and show people what they need to see or the information that they need to know. For instance, like, you know that a game is going to be cancelled, we need to be very careful in when we deliver and how we deliver that information. For instance, we cannot be like, hey, I just came out of a meeting, we're going to cancel the game, folks, because no, that's not beneficial to anyone. So we try to do the best for the team and for the game and ultimately for the players. If I was to split in a percentage on how much I focus on the game versus how much I focus on the team, definitely my at least 70% is more on the team. The people is who make the game.
Sure.
And that's my main focus. So, and I try to foster this level of communication and transparency and assertiveness and honesty across the board. If I lead with an example, I would expect people to follow, and they naturally do. And when I see things, I flag them, I call them as I see them. And people have been very professional so far. I haven't had many cases. I have had cases, but not many cases where people have been on the toxic side of things. So fortunately, everything has been fine with the teams.
How do you typically deal with? I don't even know. Maybe you can give me an example of what happened if you feel comfortable kind of sharing that. But whether that's they disagreeing with something that you said, or you know.
Disagreement is not toxicity. We can all agree to disagree. Yeah. It's more when there people start spreading rumors, for instance, or you can start getting like small groups of people.
Right, ganging up.
Okay. Like that sort of thing. Like, yo, no, like, this is not beneficial to anyone. Let's be mm-hmm. professional. We're adults here.
Yeah.
It's great that we all get along and we drink beers on Fridays. But in the end, this is a business, this is a job, and we need to be serious about it. And if you start rumors and ganging up, talking about someone, that's borderline bullying. So I flag it as I see it. But if someone has other toxic traits or whatnot, like I've dealt with people that perhaps they were very vocal or mm-hmm. negative about everything. So the negative all the time, like, this is shit, this is bad, this is blah, this is blah. So being very vocal about it, it starts spreading and
affecting
other people. Like, and the thing that I try to do is not like, yo, shut up, you're being toxic. I call things as I see them, but I also try to understand why this person feels like this. Maybe that person needs to decompress or let everything out. Like, maybe that person is not being heard enough, and that's why that person is being very vocal.
Yeah.
So I always say that producers, production is primarily a support role, but it's also a part of strategy and an organization. So to me, it has those two sides, like supporting, but also organizing. And I always say that a producer is a mix of a firefighter, a psychologist, and a diplomat. because, I mean, firefighting, we already know that we're always putting out fires because we don't want people to be affected, but we don't want the game being affected. Our primary goal is to get the game out there in the best quality, budget, and health possible. But we are always trying to avoid problems with people and with the game. Being a diplomat, because we are always creating these trade-offs, because sometimes there are conflicts of interests, like, and everybody wants to do their best work, and that's why there are conflicts of interest, because maybe art wants to do something and programming says, yo, no, this is very heavy, the game is gonna lag. I don't know, these are very simple examples, but sometimes it happens. So I have to be there, or we have to be there as producers and be the peacemakers and say, like, okay, how do we have a win-win situation here? Yeah, and the psychologist, because people, if something goes wrong, if something goes right, they oftentimes ignore you. But if something goes wrong, you're going to be the main point of contact as a producer. Even for the line managers, it's like when something is not working out, they call the producer like, hey, can you check this? Hey, can you fix this? And it's incredible that sometimes people don't even know what we do. Like I've been told by colleagues like, hey, I don't know what you do all day, but when you're not here, the house is on fire. I'm like, yeah, cheers. That's exactly it.
Nice. You're like the mom and the dad of the group. And yeah, you have this big amount of people to look after.
Yeah, but I at least I try not to be motherly, because they are adults. I if there's something that I hate with passion is when someone patronizes me. So I try to avoid it.
Yeah, I don't want to project it on other people as well.
Yeah. Fair enough. It's like, okay, when someone comes to me with a problem, I always tell them, how would you fix it? What's your suggestion? What do you think we should do? How do you feel about this? I allow and I create this space for the person to think by themselves and to be able to come up with a solution. Sometimes they do have the answer. They just don't put it into practice for whatever reasons, or maybe they have concerns, and I'm more than happy to clear up those concerns. I said, okay, from your suggestion, I will tweak maybe this and that, so everything is smoother, but off you go. And that's it.
You mentioned therapy. How long have you been going to therapy? Like, how often do you go, and do you still go? And have these ways of resolving a conflict or resolving an issue when it arises, when it comes to certain situations at work, do you take it from the therapy, like a lot of lessons that you've learned from
that? Yeah, I took a lot of things from therapy. I stopped going to therapy a year and a half ago. Only my psychologist told me, you're done.
You're done. You're fixed.
Quote unquote. I can still go back for... You know, when you have a car, you need to take it to the mechanic every once in a while once a year. That's kind of how I'm at right now. But the intense work of having therapy twice per month I had it for 4 years, nonstop, 4 or 5 years, something like that. I learned a lot about conflict resolution, about how avoiding misunderstandings, how to double check information, how to not take tones or the way people say things personally. If someone, because a lot of the conflicts come from interpretation, and producers, we do really read between lines. We have to, but I don't make something up. I don't interpret it. I think I know what's happening, so I double check. If I notice that there's some tension because of body language or some words said, instead of me going to, I don't know, and scaling it up to HR and say like, hey, there's something going on with these people, they have a conflict or whatever. No, I double check first. And I go to the person and say, hey, I heard what you said, and to me, it sounded like this. Mm-hmm. Do you mean it? Is this what you want to do? Or is this your decision? Is that what you meant? Or whatever. And if they tell me no, then it's a no.
Sure.
If they tell me, oh no, actually, yes, I was very pissed off at that meeting because X, Y, and Z, I say, okay, let's talk about it.
When you're managing remote teams, how different is it when you have to manage teams on site? And, you know, how much more difficult is it to resolve conflicts?
Well, there are less conflicts in terms of not having a lot of people in the same room, but we are in a virtual room, so to speak. And as you know, written communication is not the same as spoken. And a lot of people don't know how to handle the tone, especially if they come from a different nationality. And you must know this, the way you have your written tone in English,
it's different.
It's completely different. It needs to be even sweeter.
Yeah.
For whatever reason, things sound very blunt if you're very short and simple in English.
Yeah.
So sometimes it gets completely misinterpreted. So it's a matter of educating people on how things can be better portrayed in written form if we're talking in Slack or Discord all of the time. But the face-to-face or monitor-to-monitor communication is something that I try not to lose when I'm working remotely. Actually, I create avenues for constant communication. And working remotely has also created different kinds of communication that is more visual. I'm a fan of emoticons or emojis and GIFs. I have a GIF for everything. Or a meme.
Yeah.
So sometimes you can say 1,000 words with a meme or with a photo or with a reaction. And it's all about visibility and being present when you have a remote team. I always tell them, like, if I post something and you read it and you agree, don't ghost me, put your thumbs up. And you start creating this culture of being very visible and present, even if you're working remotely.
True. You coming to a new work environment and kind of learning more about how people are in that team and how, I guess, the environment is and how the culture is. Do you usually try and adapt to the culture? Do you try and establish your culture? Like, what does culture mean to you in general?
Wow, we're getting into HR stuff. No, I love it. It's a good question because it always makes me think when I read job descriptions or when you're in an interview process and they say that we're going to do the cultural fit interview. And I have mixed feelings about that because maybe I don't want someone to fit into a mold. Maybe I want someone to add to that mold. What positive things can that person bring to the table, right?
Sure.
Instead of just fitting into a square box. Why do we want people to fix in a square box? Maybe it's because we have a culture, quote unquote, of if it's always worked well like this, then why changing it? And that happens more often than not, even in companies that say that, oh, we're very innovative and inclusive and we're welcoming everybody. And then in the end, they don't want to get out of their box. So to me, culture is not only the values and kind of respect and that sort of thing. To me, respect should be a given. We're in a work environment and we're adults. To me, it's more like the way we work together. And even when you add one more person to a team, the dynamic and the energy changes a little bit. But it grows. It doesn't need to be necessarily a bad thing. On the contrary, it gets more dynamic, or the dynamic changes a little bit with every single person that you add. That's why rapid growth in teams can be quite a chaotic thing, because you have sort of like your synergies and the way you're working, your work culture, how teams communicate with each other. And suddenly you start adding 3 or 4 people per week. And it's like, I haven't even gotten used to the people who joined last week, when we already have new people and the dynamic changes completely.
Yeah. And that creates a lot of issues as well.
When
you have so many people in such a short period of time.
It's crazy.
It's crazy.
But it happens.
Yeah.
I've been through those type of growth like twice easily. And from being a team of 20 something or 15 or whatever, and when I leave the studio for another job, we're 100 plus. Especially remotely, or like this happened between in the pandemic, there's people that I still talk to that I've never met because we met through a monitor. Like a computer monitor. And it's like, yeah, you're my screen buddy. We still get along and we have each other added on Instagram and we share things, but and we're in the same bloody city, but for whatever reason,
that's so weird.
There's people that I've never met. Or when I worked in XR Games, they are based in Leeds in the UK. And when XR games start growing and growing, I was at some point traveling once a month, but even then, when I traveled the next time, I was like, who is this person? Like, I know them by name because I definitely know to which team they've been added. I'm the head of production and I know their role, but their face, it's completely unknown. It's like, who is this person? So yeah, that has happened.
Leeds gives me such good memories.
Really?
I went to uni in Bradford in the UK and I used to live in Leeds for 7-8 years.
My goodness. It's a party town, isn't it?
It is a party town. It's great when you're in your 20s, when you're in university. It's a lot of fun.
Yeah, I bet. I mean, I would never move there because the weather is depressing.
Oh,
and I'm not a heat kind of person, but I like light and sun.
Yeah.
And it can get very gloomy. I guess that's why people are in pubs and bars and getting drunk all the time.
Yeah, I think
because it's depressing outside.
I think so.
And the city, in terms of landscape, is not amazing either. I mean, it has its good areas and the old town is quite nice, but it's very industrial, really.
Yeah.
But it has such nice restaurants and bars. Like,
definitely.
It's a great experience going out dining there and drinking. They have a bar of every kind of theme that you can think of and that sort of thing. And people are lovely. I love people in Yorkshire, in that region.
Yeah, no, they're really nice. They're really nice. And they have beautiful outskirts as well.
Yeah, that's what they told me. That's what they told me, but I never got to explore.
You never went.
Got to explore the outskirts, or I should definitely go there more on a holiday kind of trip.
Go, yeah. Make sure you find that week when it doesn't rain. You go on holiday.
Does that exist? To be fair, when I used to go there, not every time it was raining, but it was just more like gray and gloomy.
Yeah.
But the trains don't work and I don't have a driving license. So that's an issue because the trains are not the best. So I don't know how I could explore the outskirts.
Yeah, true. Sometimes they break, sometimes they don't come in time.
Oh, yeah, I know.
If it snows, they just don't work.
I nearly missed a flight because of the snow. Because it was Barcelona, Manchester, Leeds.
Okay.
There are barely any flights to Leeds, Bradford.
Oh, yeah, from here you need to travel
it's like
to Manchester.
Once a week and it was not convenient, so it was like to Manchester. So the train to Manchester and back, especially back, going back is like, train cancelled. I'm like, oh, shoot. Then it's an Uber. So sorry, XR Games, I will need to charge this.
Goodness.
Yeah. Good times. I miss it a lot. It was great times.
So your role there was head of production.
Yeah.
So you're overseeing the entire kind of suite of projects the guys were working in?
Yeah.
How was working in VR as opposed to working in mobile and other platforms? Like, what are the differences in, you know?
Yeah, that's a good question. So I had worked in VR before that, and I loved it. Mm. The thing that I loved it is what people tend to love from VR, which is how immersive it is. Actually doing research and getting myself acquainted with VR in my first job that I did in VR, I started dreaming about the things that I saw in VR because I was spending too many hours playing VR. It's a brain trip, like what your brain can absorb. Like, your brain absorbs that as your visual truth.
Yeah.
It's crazy. And in XR Games, when I joined, it was a very small team and there was only one producer, but that changed very, very quickly. And the main difference to me, it's more on the gameplay mechanics. They tend to be much more simpler than mobile is more number data KPI driven.
Okay.
KPI, quote unquote, because now with the new business models, live games, they can exist in console and PC as well, with downloadable content. In VR, metrics are starting to be used in analytics to kind of learn how the player plays in an immersive environment. So it's not so radically different on that front anymore, but it used to be. But definitely in mobile, it's all algorithms, or mainly algorithms. Depends on the genre as well. Mm-hmm. If you play a match 3 game, that's mathematics. Strategy, sometimes that's pure numbers as well, when tower defense and that kind of game. Whereas in VR, the mechanics need to be simple. People don't last long playing in VR. Not everybody can have the headset on for hours and hours. That get gets very heavy.
I know. I had a PSVR and I couldn't play more than half an hour, I think. I mean, I just get dizzy.
The average. Yeah. Ah, you got motion sickness.
Yeah.
Yeah, motion sickness is something that we take into account quite a bit when we're creating games. If you play the first VR games or the old ones, it was all about, they wanted to create something so real that it was like real-time movement. There's a game specifically that I recall called Adrift, I think. It was like an astronaut simulator. I couldn't get past the tutorial. I get motion sickness very, very easily, but that thing, that kind of destroyed me even in the tutorial. But the new games, they kind of use teletransportation so you don't get dizzy. You just point and click and you appear in the other place.
Okay.
And that's how you kind of move so you don't have that motion sickness. Still, you can get it, but it's not that frequent anymore. And I read a study that it's actually more prevalent in women and hormones have to do with that.
Okay.
It's fascinating. But also, you are in a completely immersive environment, 360 degrees. The mechanics work differently. Your UI, your buttons, you need to have them in front of you. You can click them. You can have haptics. It's not the same as having a menu in mobile where the icons are very small but very shouty visually because they need to be seen in a very small device and where you can display a lot of menus. In VR, it's not like, hey, I'm going to grab this device and I'm going to see the menus. You can. And there are some games that you actually have like a watch or something, but you see it in front of you or you have the interface in front of you. So the mechanics are more like about that experience and more easy. Like puzzles work very well in VR. Shooters work very well in VR because it's like boom, boom, boom.
I played No Man's Sky. In VR.
How was it?
That was amazing.
Yeah.
That was amazing. I mean, it was like a few years ago. I probably improved it even more now. But just the whole experience of getting into a spaceship and I don't know, driving it in VR and going into space.
Yeah.
I mean, that was incredible. And I also played Resident Evil.
I was going to ask about that one.
Oh, that was like the scariest.
It's so scary, isn't it?
I couldn't, half an hour I'd play it and then that's it. I mean, I wouldn't be able to. And I would play it with the headphones on as well and be like, you know, trying to, I don't know, crawl some kind of a dark basement and seeing what's... Oh, it was just scary as hell.
It's very scary. I played Resident Evil as well. And that's the thing, especially with horror games, but with any game in VR, you get a lot of stimuli. Visual, sound, haptics. So your brain really registers as if you were there.
Yeah.
So if you get an information or senses overload, you cannot focus on what you have to do in the game or in the level. That's why it's not very advisable to have very complex mechanics because you're overwhelmed with everything else.
Yeah.
If that makes sense.
True. No, that makes a lot of sense. It's like you're reliving it in the game. And yeah, you have to deal with a lot of other stuff instead of like thinking how to pass the level, etc.
No, the games are getting more complex now.
Yeah.
But that's because people are getting more used to VR now. And it was still a very immature market. The more people will play, the more they will get used to all of this.
Do you still play VR games? And is that a game that you're looking forward to?
I haven't played in a while. I have my Quest 2 and now there's Quest 3. And I definitely once I get my PlayStation 5 at some point in life, I don't have one. They're crazy expensive. But once I have one, I will definitely want to have the headset because that kind of eliminates a lot of the friction. You have a console game in your console and you just plug and play your VR set and you're done. The Quest 2 is great because it's a standalone, so you don't need to plug it to anything unless you want to download a game and you plug it to Steam or to the Quest Store. Yeah, it doesn't have much friction, but for me, having it as part of the console always makes more sense. I don't know why, but I haven't played in a minute, which is a shame. But definitely there are games that I'm looking forward to. Like XR games with Rebellion Day are just about to launch Zombie Army. The trailer is out there.
Okay.
Yeah.
Wow. That's
I couldn't speak about
scary.
It before. But it's very, very much in the lines of Zombieland, of course, with a lot of differences, but it's let's shoot zombies. And that works so well in VR.
Yeah. It's quite common for these AAA studios to partner up with VR specialist studios to work on set on IPs, right? Like Guerrilla partnered up with FireSprite on the Horizon, and
it makes a lot of sense. Yeah. You hire the specialist in VR. Yeah. They know how to do the immersiveness. They know how to tweak the existing gameplay and take it to VR. They know what works and what doesn't work. You cannot just create, you cannot just do a port, basically. You can port from PC to console and backwards, but mobile and VR, they do have their very specific things in terms of gameplay that you need to take into account, because they're different platforms. The same as console and PC, but I think those are more portable between them or between consoles. So it's like, why are we going to hire and grow the team for one project if we can do co-development or count on another studio to do this?
Sure. Makes sense.
Yeah.
Women in games. I wanted to ask you about that.
Yeah,
so
sure.
I read that you are Women in Games ambassador.
Mm-hmm.
I just wanted to ask about the organization as a whole. What do you do there? Do you have any specific tasks, you know, within an organization? Like, what made you join? And is there any specific things that maybe you're working with when it comes to organization as well, currently?
Yeah, I'm a huge advocate for more women in games. Mm-hmm. And this was around 2016 or something, there's more than one organization. There's also Women in Games International, which is a different organization. Okay. I like them all, to be honest. It's just that I got to know this one and I asked what I could do to be an ambassador, or if there were any specific activities or things that I could get involved in. I was a nominee for Breakthrough Talent as well in Women in Games. They have their own awards. Cool. And I had some friends sending their pitch on why I should be nominated. And when I was nominated,
that's cool.
I was like, that's very sweet. Yeah, I went to London to the ceremony and everything. I met great, great women working in video games. And to be fair, in the last year since the pandemic, my role in Women in Games has been more on the backstage. It's not something that I report to them daily or in a weekly basis or anything. I try to advocate for more women in games on my own when I am having these positions of leadership, trying to mentor more women or trying to get them to be ambassadors as well. But there are things that that we can do. It's just that I haven't had the time yet. And the organization also it has grown massively. I don't know how many ambassadors are around the world.
There's a lot, yeah.
A billion.
But it's great.
It's great.
The more, the better.
Yeah, yeah. And we have a career expo and we have conferences that I attend to either as a listener. I haven't been a speaker yet, but I hope I can be one day. It's just that my day-to-day job has taken so much in the past years, especially since I started being a lead, right? Mm-hmm. That I haven't been doing so many initiatives, because before you could ask them for advice or even a small budget so you could create something in your town or go and speak in a school or something in the name of Women in Games, and they provided the materials and everything.
Sure.
Since the pandemic, I think it just shuffled and put everything upside down. So I'm still part of Women in Games and I follow them and I follow the initiatives. I read the newsletter every month that is being sent. It's just that my work, it has been more on my own, kind of mentoring more women and always trying to
How does that go? Do they reach out to you for mentorship?
Like sometimes, sometimes they ask me, or sometimes if I have women in the studio, I always like to talk to them.
Sure.
Like, hey, what would you like to do? Is there anything that I can help you with? Etc. Because there are a lot more now, but there aren't that many of us, at least in leadership.
It's true. And to be honest, I mean, whenever you go through, you know, the percentages of women who work in certain studios, I mean, it's always like 20% or 25% or less, which is...
Yeah, one time I heard of, I'm not going to say who it was, but that person told me, yeah, in the studio, we try not to hire women for producer roles because it's a support role and you can get pregnant, you know?
That's horrible.
I'm like,
that's absolutely horrible.
Excuse me? Yeah, but maybe people don't say it, but there are some people that still have their biases, or there are things attached to women and our sex that it seems that the world has made it incompatible, or the system has made it incompatible with what we want to do or with our careers or whatever. So yeah, that's kind of the door that we're trying to break, right? Like,
yeah. Yeah. I mean, if there are companies or people that still think that way, I mean, there's definitely a lot of work that needs to be
done.
But
they're not vocal about it because they can't.
Of course. No. but that's just horrible.
The actions are different. I'm not going to say which experience of mine in work, because I don't like bath mouthing anybody or being specific, but I've had experiences where the main affected have been females, or the people leaving have been females.
Yeah.
At least five or something. And it's like, well, something's going on when the females are the ones having trouble, or the company's having trouble with the females. It's like, what's going on? Shocking that still happens, but it does. On the other hand, I've been very fortunate that the majority of the studios that I work with is like, we're equals. Naturally, they have less women because it comes from education. Even like, there's a lot of girls that they don't even know that video games is an option. To me, it came even very late. When I wanted to join video games, I was, 26 or something, when I started thinking about it seriously, like, this is what I want to do. And I was like, dude, it's so natural. I've been playing video games my whole life. Was that even an option? Nobody told me that was an option. So it comes from education, for sure. But little by little, more and more women are joining, which is great.
That's good. I mean... Yeah, the more the better. And yeah.
I always get excited when I see a CEO, a woman of a studio. I'm like, yeah, you go, girl. Because it's very difficult to be in leadership. Like, now we have more women in video games. The next step for me is seeing more women in the leadership roles, like CEO, COO, executive producer, technical.
I've been seeing more indie studios opening up with women in leadership roles recently. Yeah. Which is definitely very welcome.
Yeah, for sure. More women taking taking the lead and say like, hey, okay, so the studio won't hire me. I'm going to open my own studio. And that's it. Yeah, it's great.
Yeah. To maybe finish this off with everything that's happening in the industry at the moment. This is obviously going for a bit of a rough patch.
But yeah.
A lot of layoffs, a lot of changes.
Tell me about it.
What are your thoughts on it? Like, why is this happening? Have you been expecting this to happen? And, you know, what's your kind of take on it in general?
I mean, to begin with, I'm one of those affected. Mm-hmm. I mean, I wasn't laid off per se because of our restructuring. I left my previous job because it was extremely toxic, and I got caught up in the middle of the wave, unfortunately. So... I've never seen the industry like it is right now. At the beginning, it kind of resembled when I joined the industry. It was extremely difficult to join the industry. It was an economical crisis. Studios were gatekeeping everything, or people, their experience, like, no, we only want this and this and that. And they were very hard on their recruitment. So that part, I was like, oh yeah, I remember. Maybe this is a cycle. It comes and goes. And more experienced people that have been in the industry for 20 years, they have been telling me the same. Like, hey, it's a cycle. Every now and then it happens in the industry. Yeah. It breaks and then it restructures itself. But in my case, in the 9 years that I've been working in the industry, I've never seen it like this. So to me, it's scary. But it is true that a lot of studios scaled up ridiculously fast and a lot during the pandemic, because of course people are in their homes. What do? They play more, they consume more. Also, the business models have been more and more aggressive, in my opinion. They've been more mobile, like where you have downloadable content all of the time, like events, live operations, passes. I'm not a fan of that kind of business model. I know there are a lot of gamers that they are fans of that. Like Fortnite, for instance. I like playing Fortnite, but like buying the passes and the seasons and whatnot. I like playing a game, starting a game and finishing it, and maybe a DLC that is super cool. And next, I'm that kind of gamer.
Same. Same here.
Fantastic.
I
mean,
I, Well, that's the thing. I feel like there's, as well, there's been just a lot of content and, you know, how much...
I'm overwhelmed.
Yeah. But how much can you play? How much can you watch things in general?
There are games that are ridiculously big, like Skyrim.
Mm-hmm.
You can be playing... It's not even like live operations or whatever, but the game, you can play it and you can be a different thing every time you play it, and you cannot. I haven't even finished the game. And
I don't know if anyone has finished.
Exactly, it's ridiculously big, but at least it's one game, and I know that I have it there. Or I like it when there are options, like you can finish the game, or you can have this game mode where you go online and you play with other people. Well, that there's option there because it's you can pick and choose. So I think the business models have been more aggressive. The studios have scaled up quite quickly a lot without realizing that this wasn't going to be maintained, because sooner or later things would go back to normal. People would be, unfortunately, required to go to the office again, so they wouldn't be able to play between breaks, for instance, at their homes. And that kind of puts everything into perspective of what's happening now. I mean, also, it's been like the biggest fish is eating the small fish, and then comes a shark and it's the big fish, and so on with company mergers. Like, there's one company that absorbs a small studio, but then comes a monster of a company, I'm not going to say names, and then absorbs all of that, and then comes a massive group.
Yeah.
From specific countries, and then absorbs everything and has a portfolio of I don't know how many big studios. So that when you merge companies, inevitably there's going to be like duplicated roles as well.
It's of like, course, yeah.
It's like, hey, there's only room for one of these who's going to prevail, and oftentimes it's from the company that absorbs the smaller studio, the big fish. So I think there's a lot of components. It's been like the perfect storm for things to happen.
Everything
right now
kind of just jammed into one. And yeah, I mean, I see it similarly. I said there's too much content. There has been a lot of acquisitions. Funny thing I read today was all over LinkedIn that one of those companies bought itself out, which is welcome news.
Of course. We're about to start seeing divorces now. I mean, like, hey, their relationship is not working out.
It's not working out.
Don't sink me with you. Like, you're sinking. Don't take me with you. I want to divorce now. It makes sense. I think we're going to be seeing a lot of that.
And there's a lot of indie companies popping up, you know, a lot of small studios that receive investment. They're working on some cool things.
Yeah, there's still a lot of gatekeeping in terms of AAA, by the way, because there was a lot of people saying like AAA or quadruple A, if we can call it like that. Yeah, Skyrim, it's much more than a AAA, and Zelda as well, and those kind of games.
Yeah,
it's dead. Because they have been gatekeeping their professionals and their technology and their development, and they think they are la creme de la creme, and they have the most aggressive business model. So there's quite a bit of people that are saying like AAA is dead, but they are still gatekeeping quite a bit, even if the industry is like this. I have found myself in the position where I'm looking for work, even for more junior positions, and they tell me, you would need a couple of more AAA titles in your CV. It's like, yo, are you serious?
That's so ridiculous. Yeah, when it comes to AAA, and talking from experience of being a recruiter as well, some of the requirements that the companies have, and you know, the people that review the CVs in some cases. I mean, when a person comes from an experience of working on doing mobile and VR and PC, they might have not done console. But to be honest, the mechanics are very similar. You know, you work with people, and in some cases, producing a mobile game, it's so much more complex.
Somebody told me this as well. Like, sometimes the fires and the trouble that you find, not even in depending on the platform, but depending on the size of the company, that the problems that you find in smaller companies are really what make you or break you. And that's absolutely true. I mean, hey ho, it's being like an abusive cycle. It's funny to me that some companies say like, oh, we're so sorry about these layoffs. We have these positions open. We're welcoming applicants, etc. They review your CV. And now they have this massive pool of talent that they can cherry pick whoever they want. So it's like, don't become what you are against.
Exactly.
Of like, practice what you preach, basically.
Exactly.
But they don't realize it. So it's been very difficult for a lot of people. At least I get called to interviews. Like, I'm being called and I'm doing quite a bit. Hopefully I will land a job soon. But there's people that have heard crickets for months and months or even a year now.
Yeah. It's a shame. Hopefully, you know, the industry will sort itself out. Hopefully there's more opportunities for those people. Or, you know, if they can't find something, maybe they're able to create something on their own.
Or leave the industry.
You know, or, yeah, I guess that's
at least temporarily, yeah, until it fixes itself. It's something that I consider as well. Like, maybe I can do something else. And I tried, but they see my CV that everything that I've done is video games. And even if the transferable skills are there, like, why do you want to be here? Rejected.
Fair enough. Fair. Look, really nice to meet you.
Yeah, you too. Thank you.
I really enjoyed the conversation. It was brilliant, and I don't even know where the time went, to be honest.
Yeah, it's fine. It's all good.
So thank you so much.
And, cheers.
Hopefully we'll see each other again, maybe.
Yeah. Next time.